G'day, humans. Welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas. Here's an uncomfortable question for you. Could the gains of the gay rights movement over the past few decades be reversed in coming decades by the Christian right, by changing attitudes of conservative migrant communities, by the gay rights' strategy at the moment of hitching itself to an unpopular LGBTQIA plus ideology that many people are more suspicious of than they were of the original requests of the gay rights activists? Ronan McRae has written a book about this. He's a professor of constitutional and European law at University College London. He lectures on the relationship between religion and law. He's a former barrister, a lawyer for the Refugee Legal Centre, and an assistant to a judge in the European Court of Justice. His new book is called The End of the Gay Rights Revolution: How Hubris and Overreach Threaten Gay Freedom. I hope you enjoy as much as I did Ronan McRae. What's interesting, I think, or maybe striking for the way that you frame gay rights is that you don't really regard the ascendancy and the success of the gay rights revolution as being something that we should analyze outside of the context of all of the other social changes that were happening in the 1960s through to the 1980s. And you have this funny comparison with Estonian liberation and gay rights liberation. Do you want to make that case?
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, one of the core points of the book is that we have to see gay rights as basically an incidental side effect of wider changes in, and as I say, right, it's like in Estonian independence. Estonians had to fight hard for it, a lot of heroes, they had to push. But Estonian independence movement was getting nowhere unless the USSR had declined and fallen apart. And similarly, the gay rights movement really was a downstream effect of the fact that in the 60s, 70s onwards, straight people gave themselves a lot more freedom. We had cohabitation, contraception, abortion, no-fault divorce. You know, over those few decades, straight people established for themselves a choice, an individualist-based paradigm, and then they had to be pushed to apply that to gay people. Gay marriage made zero sense in 1950 or 1960, when marriage for straight people was lifelong and about supporting children. But once marriage became about helping individual straight people realize themselves and have the best support, the nice relationships they had, well, then why exclude gay people? And same reason, so with all of those things, it was basically the claims that brought gay rights to fruition, which was people should have the right to run their own love lives. There are no rules. Those claims actually were endorsed by straight people first. And so the task of the gay rights movement was not to tell straight people gay rights are wonderful, or gay people and gay sex and gay where sexuality is wonderful. It's actually just to say, look, the rules are freedom and choice. Give us the freedom and choice. And I go through in the book, that's the history. It starts with decriminalization. Look at the arguments made across the Western world for decriminalization. It wasn't gay is good. It was people have the right to run their own sex lives. Mm. And basically,
and sorry to interrupt, but it was also based on the selling point that you don't have to change anything, you being the broader society. You've already made all of these changes for yourselves. You've decided to change, to redefine marriage by introducing no-fault divorce. You've decided to change the mores around sexuality in order to accept permissive promiscuity, if you wish. And therefore, all we're asking for is the same things that you've given yourself, and you don't have to. We're not going to ask you to do anything other than not discriminate against us.
Yeah, we just need a tiny tweak. You've got the paradigm is there, and we just need a minor adjustment to apply it to us. There was tension because there were, right from the start, radical people in the gay rights movement who saw it as just part of a movement to overthrow all established
normies,
institutions and stuff. But, you know, over time, particularly in the 90s and 2000s, when the gay rights movement had its big success, those became marginal voices because, it's kind of natural. If you think of it, you have to be a pretty rebellious person to be out in 1970. So the movement actually did have quite a strong radical movement. By the 1990s, it's a bit easier, more kind of mainstream-oriented people will come out. They have an agenda of things like employment protections, relationship recognition, gay marriage, that kind of stuff. Then what we get into the book is that mid-2010s, that's mainly done and dusted. The normies disengage from the movement again, and it becomes more radical, which I see as a problem in itself, but also a big problem because the big trends, the kind of equivalent of the collapse of the USSR, the trends that drove the success of the gay rights revolution and the straight sexual revolution, individualism, feminism, secularization, all of those are losing force. So the forces that drove the success of gay rights are weakening at the very time that the gay rights movement has been upping its demands and asking for more. And that, I think, is a particularly risky combination.
And is the gay rights movement upping its demands and asking for more, or is it expanding its remit and including, you know, you talk about the transition of the gay rights movement into the LGBTQIA plus community, so to speak, and the liability inherent in asking the rest of the population to sign on to what seems like an indefinite and rather vague upending of a lot of traditions that they hold dear, which doesn't seem consistent with the original pitch, which was, you keep on doing the same things that you're always doing, let us do them as well.
Sure, yeah, because I think, yeah, there's two ways. Up the demands in terms of having a whole month of pride and flags. Sometimes a bit of liberal too, you know, mandatory or semi-mandatory ally groups at work. There have been cases in the UK, US of people being punished for out-of-work statements that against homosexuality, things like that. That was one.
Yes, right. Yeah, there's another anecdote along those lines which comes up in Australia all the time, which is, should athletes have to wear pride jerseys when they're on the field? And you've got quite a lot of South Pacific Islander players who are fantastic, you know, rugby players, for example, and they may be deeply Christian, which is quite commonplace in Tonga or Fiji, where they might come, or Samoa. And so all of a sudden, they're being expected as part of their job to wear a rainbow flag on their jersey when they have, it has nothing to do with it. And they're regarded as being full of hate because they don't necessarily want to have to.
And there's been the same issue in Europe with soccer players, mainly of Muslim background, and some African Christian background too, who haven't wanted to wear rainbow stuff. And actually, that's true. I mean, the gay rights movement was the right to be left alone was our key claim. Our key claim was up for employment was, you don't have to approve what I do, just don't fire me. Let me do what I want in my own time. And we, like, organizations like Human Rights Campaign in the US, Stonewall in the UK, which are probably the equivalent in Australia, have really undermined that by saying out of work anti-gay statements can lead to disciplinary consequences. Your personal life is your business. Your employer needs to support you and cheer you on. And first, it's kind of needy. It's kind of please.
Well, needy, you know, is a polite way of putting it, Ronan. I mean, authoritarian or Stalinist would be another.
There's definitely authoritarian bit. I mean, who wants their employer in their private life? Nobody really, no real liberal. But also, like, Walmart, tell me you love me. Even if Walmart mouths the words, we love you, they don't. Because Walmart wasn't backing gay rights in 1975.
If you want to know whether Walmart loves you because it puts a rainbow flag on its social media profile in the United States and the UK and Australia, why don't you go and check what their social media profile has in Saudi Arabia or, in the UAE? And when they put a pride flag up in the UAE version of their website, then I'll believe that.
Then it's true love.
Then it's true love. Yeah. But I mean, also, it's so short. It strikes me as so short-sighted to think that you're always going to be on the winning side. And so you should expand your demands, you know, so much that you want employers and co-workers to all be meddling around in what you're personally tweeting. And we need to make sure that everybody is on the same page as us, as if you can be guaranteed that in perpetuity, those kinds of intrusions are always going to work in your favor. I mean, you know, tomorrow it might be, you know, the mood might swing and people will be pouring over your LGBTQIA plus tweets and punishing you for those.
And it goes from a kind of risky bet to madness when you consider this is a population that is 3-4%, tiny minority everywhere. Everywhere in the world, gay people are a tiny minority. And it's a population that has spent 99% of history being persecuted and hated by almost everybody. So the idea that I like 15 years of success means you don't need to worry about that anymore. You'll always be on the winning side. You can throw out the liberal principles that got you your freedom is complete, is madness. It's this kind of end of history delusion that you think, oh, well, history always moves in this one way. And therefore, the last 20 years or 15 or 20 years of success that we've had represent an irreversible change. And that, I mean, gets back to what you're also saying about the expansion of the agenda in terms of LGBT to LGBTQ+. In some ways, that goes back to the early days where there was real radicalism in the early days of the gay rights movement. But it also, if you look at it, the main gay rights groups in the West all said until around mid-2010s that, you know, good luck to the trans rights movement, but it's not our movement. And they said that for a couple of reasons. First, you know, there are instances where the causes don't fully align. The trans rights movement actually in the European Union and the European Court of Human Rights actually had a lot of success getting marriage rights and employment protections before gay people got them. And that was a good move. They had to separate themselves from gay people and say, just accommodate us. But also, until the mid-2010s, all other movements were clear that it's just too risky. We have large amounts of opposition. We're looking for these employment protections, marriage rights. We won't get them if we kind of expand our agenda. But now they've gone not just to LGBT, but LGBTQ+. They've gone back. The plus is the most concerning thing, really, because the opponents of gay rights always say, these people want you to change everything that you value. And we have been making that case for them. Because if your movement has ambitions that are so ongoing and so limitless that it requires a mathematical symbol plus to represent what the gay rights, the LGBTQ plus center of New York calls, plus represents, they say, genders and sexual orientations that language cannot yet describe. So if your political agenda is so wide that it needs a symbol to represent sexual orientations and gender identities that language cannot describe, you are maximizing your opposition. You are telling moderate straight people, accommodating us means you have to change everything. Effectively, this kind of blank check to throw out all established norms. For a minority of 3-4%, that is absolute political madness.
Mm. It's incredible, isn't it, to imagine, you know, trying to sell that from first principles instead of having evolved to it over the course of decades. You know, a minority coming to a more powerful group of people and saying, can you sign on to our agenda? And the more powerful group of people say, all right, what's your agenda? And they go, well, you know, we've got these bullet points, but also then we've got an ellipsis and then infinity. And the majority is like, what? Yeah, the majority is like, wait, what? What am I signing up to? We don't know exactly, but in the future, there may be things that language cannot yet describe that we want you on board with us for. The majority would be like, wait, get this guy out of here. What are we talking about?
It's a package. I know it's a package deal. Take it all or none. Like, you're either in favor of biological males participating in sports, or you're homophobic. And I think the idea behind that is that you can leverage popular issues like gay marriage and say, okay, well, I'm going to be homophobic, so fine. More likely, I think people will end up saying, they will end more likely to end up reconsidering their support for core gay issues than they are to put aside their concerns about things like sports.
Mm. And they already are doing to some degree.
Yeah. And yeah, sorry. Think about the history thing, that like just... How could a movement of 3-4% of people do that? And the only reason is if they believe in that end of history thinking. They believe that their victories are truly irreversible. And, you know, with the war in Ukraine, with the rise of Viktor Orban and Vladimir Putin and sundry other developments of the world, we all know history didn't end in the 1990s. But somehow, for some reason, in the gay movement, rights movement, this end of history thinking is lumbering on in zombie form. And it's really causing us to maximize the chances that we're going to lose what we have. Because historically, if we hold half what we have now in 50 years' time, we'll be doing better than gay people, still be doing better than gay people did for 99% of human history. Mm. We've got to recognize how exceptional what we have now is and how lucky we would have we to hold on to it. Our task is to hold on to things, not keep pushing further and further and further.
That will sound like defeatism to people who feel like the status quo is still intolerable for transgender people who are routinely demeaned and mocked and derided and in subtle ways every single day made to feel like second-class citizens, taunted by the President of the United States and so on. Why not say, yes, there's probably a cost to this, but principles matter and unity matters and solidarity matters, and we're not going to throw our weaker partners under the bus just so that we can greedily hoard our personal gains?
Well, I'd say first, we should remember that half the world, there's been no gay rights yet anyway, but even putting that aside, the other thing to remember is that the current arrangement of making it all a package deal isn't working for trans rights either. Their numbers have been going backwards, actually worse than gay rights numbers have been declining. And
you mean the amount of support for trans rights, not the number of trans people?
Sorry, exactly. Yeah, the numbers in terms of percentage of people, and actually, it's not even the new things they've been looking for, the increase of self ID or sports, things like that. Things that you in the UK and the US, things that used to have majority support, now those numbers are dropping. So making it all a package deal definitely doesn't work for the gay rights movement, because it expands, it creates new enemies we didn't have. But with trans rights movement neither. It's not for me, because I'm not trans to tell the trans rights movement what to do, but I suspect that the most successful, the highest likelihood for success for them is if they can pitch to the straight cisgender majority and say, look, we don't need you to change everything, we just need a tweak. In the same way gay people would make the same pitch. But once you put them all together, you portray our movement as exactly what our opponents want people to think. It's a movement, LGBTQ+. It is a movement dedicated that requires the change of all traditional norms. That's bad for gay rights, and I says it's bad for trans rights too.
Well, it's a point of... we don't know whether or not the variable that has undermined the support for trans rights is it's being hitched to the LGBTQIA+ movement, or whether the relevant variable is the overreach that trans activists have insisted upon, which would exist in isolation, whether or not they were hitched to gay rights, right? I mean, the tweak that you say that you think that they should be asking for is what people like Dana Byer, who is a ferociously smart trans woman and activist in the States who's been on this show, would say is like all of those tweaks were effectively achieved. I think it's Bostock, the Supreme Court decision in the United States, which outlawed discrimination against trans people. So with the exception of a few things to sort of sort out at the edges, like who goes to what prison, and who competes in Little League, the basic foundations of outlawing trans discrimination have been achieved. Therefore, the strategic error would be the attempt by trans activists, though not by a lot of trans people in my personal experience, but the trans activist lobby, to push for a wholesale reevaluation of what gender is and ask the whole rest of society to announce their own preferred genders and genuflect towards a new theory about human biology and sex. That presumably could have happened whether or not the two movements were linked.
It probably is both, and it's probably hard I don't know, you'd have to do some very clever experiment or some series of coding to go to disaggregate the two. And but even like, so yeah, let's assume that you're right, that actually the association with gay rights is a plus for the trans rights movement. Is it therefore a betrayal if the gay movement does not stay in this coalition? So imagine the scenario, I guess we'll think through that. It's a plus for the trans rights movement and it's a minus for the gay rights movement. Is there a moral duty on the gay rights movement to stay in this coalition? Well, my point, I there's two reasons I think there isn't actually. One is there are some instances in which some of the claims made in the name of trans rights are considered by at least a good chunk of gay people as interfering with their interests. So I would say things like the interaction of self-ID and, say, the right of lesbians to have biologically female-only spaces. The issue of what we call youth gender medicine, because the statistics show that 80% of children who think they might be trans end up as gay, cisgender adults. So there are definitely instances where there are some tensions between the interests of gay people and some of the claims made in the name of the trans rights movement. So that's one reason.
And just to pick up, can I just drill into that for 1 second without derailing you?
Yeah.
I also think it's worth straight cis listeners to be aware of the fact that there are a lot of gay males of a certain age who feel like the need to conform to a certain stereotypical form of masculinity was very damaging to them when they were younger, and that it's wonderful that we now have a more capacious view of what masculinity can be, which includes campness and drag and not liking sports and all the kinds of things that we associate with little camp gay boys. But that the trans revolution allows those personality traits to be interpreted as making the boy less than male and possibly a woman. And it actually closes and narrows the definition of what it is okay to be as a man, and occludes many male experiences that are normal gay camp experiences, and suddenly others them into this other category and makes it harder for young gay males, especially, and young gay females, I'm sure, who are tomboys and, you know, who don't conform to the normal stereotype of femininity, to think of themselves as legitimate members of that gender, because all of a sudden, well, maybe they're not.
Yeah, I mean, one of the I think key aims of the gay rights movement has been to allow gay men and lesbians to say, I am fully a man, I am fully a woman, and you don't, the fact that I'm same-sex attracted doesn't change that. And there's always grey areas in this, and I'm sure some trans activists would just dispute that account and say, we're just wanting everyone to be more relaxed about gender norms in general. But there's definitely some scope for tension in the idea that departing from traditional gender norms means you are in some way less of the sex that you were born in.
So I don't want to derail. I want to get you back on.
So the other point, I will quickly say that there was a survey recently in the US of gays and lesbian people, and they did say that they asked gays and lesbians, who do you feel a lot in common with, or a good bit in common with, or a lot? 51% said they've had a good bit or a lot in common with straight people. Only 31% said the same about trans people. And that's not to say there's any hostility, but it shows that the experiences are very different. And, you know, which leads to my other point, which is that, sure, the gay rights movement has many of the same enemies as the trans rights movement. It has some overlapping. There's definitely large overlaps. But that's also true of many movements. Campaign to separate church and state, a lot of feminist movements, the pro-choice and abortion movement, they all have some overlap with many of the arguments that gay rights movement has. They've had many of the same enemies. That doesn't mean that they are one and the same campaign. And it doesn't mean they won't be destructive to were fair to acquire gay people to hostage their campaign to the success of this other broader campaigns. I mean, as I mentioned in the book, like, it would be madness for feminists in Russia to say no women's rights without gay rights. Or in Iran, where there is some degree of trans rights are recognized by the regime, but there's a death penalty for homosexuality, it would be crazy to say to Iranian trans activists that they require them to say no trans rights without gay rights. Because it's not like the mullahs would then say, okay, fair enough, we'll start doing gay marriages. They would probably reconsider their commitment to the very limited degree of trans rights they have now recognized.
That is interesting. Yeah, Iran is like a petri dish where the power roles are flipped from what it is in the West, isn't it? Where, you know, you get an example of where the LGBTQIA plus phenomenon, if it existed, would be one where the T is the one that already has the rights and is trying, and the G and the L are trying to drag themselves into it, rather than the other way around.
It's a strange, because there's not that many. Even the movement for racial equality has overlapped with the gay rights movement, but nobody thinks we need to add another B for black to LGBTQ plus B, you know?
What are those overlaps, though? They don't strike me as similar as trans and... I mean, trans and gay, they occupy the same universe because they play around with, I guess, the performative... I was going to say the performativity of our gender, but that's very sort of deracinating to homosexuality to think that it has something to do with performative gender. It often doesn't. I mean, often, you know, there are lots of gay people who present as straight and don't have different gender characteristics from the rest of the male population. What is it? I mean, what is the steel man the case for why trans and gay belong together more than gay and black rights do?
So I would say, yeah, the strongest case is that both gay people and trans people do depart from the behaviors expected of their birth sex in very significant ways.
Yes, right.
And they have both traditionally been, in most societies or many societies, been punished for that. And they've been mocked, etc. So I would think that's the reason. And there is a real significant overlap in that. Right? I'm saying, you know, the overlap with other movements is it's just different, right? So the gay rights claim is an autonomy claim to be left alone. That would be probably true of abortion rights. With feminism, I think it is quite actually, there's a very big overlap, because the reason women suffered in the past was that it was considered in some way immoral for a woman to do a, quote, man's job, to be a lawyer, engineer, to be this. Like, and actually, that's one of the reasons that feminism is one of the real fuels for the gay rights movement, because if a woman's choice of career shouldn't be constrained by her sex, why should her choice of romantic partner? Yeah, and, you know, mutatis mutandis, yeah, applies to gay men too. So I think there might even be a bigger overlap with feminism than any other group. But there is, you know, there's definitely...
That's interesting. Yeah, let me just wrestle with that for a second. So if you think about burning bras and controversies over women wearing pants instead of skirts in the office and being entitled to not be the objects of sexual overtures in a workplace, those are all requests basically for female biology to not require them to express their gender in a particular gendered way, for us to ignore the performativity of gender and treat people equally. And that is the common thread between feminism and gay rights, and also feminism and trans rights in that respect, because it's about liberating us from the expectations of our biological sexual destiny in some way. But you could imagine there being, instead of there having been an LGBT or an LGB movement, it could have been an FLGB or an FT.
I think there's slightly more attention. So I think you're right. There is a big overlap in both cases. I mean, Yeah, so the gay rights and feminist movements both say there is no moral reason, there's no immorality in people departing from traditional gender norms. That's true. The trans rights movement says that to some degree too. But it's slightly different because the gay rights movement has generally said it doesn't, there is no further significance to the fact that I depart from this norm about who I'm attracted to. The feminist movement said there is no further significance to me wanting my femaleness and me being a lawyer or an engineer or whatever it is. The trans movement also says trans people should be allowed to express their gender identity, which I think is absolutely right and should not be mocked or fired or anything. But they don't quite say it has no relevance. They're actually saying the departure, my desire to depart from, or the tension between my biological sex and my identity is such that actually we need to take action and change how society sees me. So there is an overlap, but there's probably more, in some ways there's more differences between gay rights and trans rights campaigns than there is between the feminist campaign and the gay rights campaign. Now, I think there's other issues with the feminism because very recently, I think we see growing trends within feminism that question the kind of anything goes approaches to sex that gay men have embraced. But that's different from the ideological underpinnings, where I think in relation to gay rights and trans rights, there's some tension as well as large overlap. With the feminist movement, there's probably less tension than a very large overlap. So yeah,
right. And is your depiction of trans requests there, or trans activist requests, true of the traditional, what we would have called transgender requests for, transsexual requests for equality, or is it only relevant to the newer model of gender fluid, non-binary, gender is a spectrum, sex is a spectrum ideology that has arisen in the past decade as a popular meme?
It's certainly more, I think it's more of a problem in relation to the more recent claims in relation to youth gender medicine. Sex is a spectrum. For same-sex attracted people, obviously there's an issue around that.
Unpack that for people who aren't quite as in the weeds.
Oh, sorry, yeah. If people define themselves as being as same-sex attracted, the idea that sex is all just a spectrum kind of undercuts the idea of same-sex attraction, because if same-sex attraction is important, then sex is important, and sex, not as in biological sex, is important. So not for all gay people, some gay people are happy with spectrums, but I think for a good chunk of gay people, they see themselves as what defines them as gay is their attraction to another biological sex,
and that's true of straight people as well. Most straight women are straight because they're attracted to the male biology. Physiologically, and to have a biological female who has undergone no medical intervention announce that she's male because sex is a spectrum and gender is a fantasy that we all make up anyway would not pass muster with most fully straight women, unless they wanted to play around, and be a bit bi. That's the way they would think about it. They wouldn't be thinking, oh yes, this is definitely a man's vagina.
Yeah. But what the main thing is, when you say, I think the tension, there's always some tension because, the gay rights movement has been about saying gender variance has no consequence for your status as a man or woman, and the trans movement, even in the more limited campaigns that they previously had, questions that a little bit. But my main, I suspect, is most gay people, because there are overlaps, would rightly wish trans people well, would rightly wish them not to have any discrimination in employment, never be insulted, have the right to run their lives, call themselves whatever name they want, all these, be facilitated to a very large degree in their desire to live as in accordance with their gender identity. But that has never meant it's that they are the same campaigns. That this, the overlap does not mean the same. And, just as feminists are entitled not to mortgage their success to the success of gay rights. Gay rights, gay people are entitled to have a campaign for themselves and not to sacrifice it. They can wish trans people well. There is a slight, I'd say, niggle with that in that having merged the movements about 10 years ago, you know, it's easier to get divorced. It's easier not to get together than to get divorced. So, you know, because most of those movements did, like Stonewall and Human Rights Campaign, merged 10 years ago, they would have to do the kind of demerging sensitively, quietly over time. I can see at the moment, like when trans people feel under attack in the US, and it wouldn't be a nice look to be publicly dumped by the LGB.
So you don't release a press statement saying, a press release saying that we're no longer together.
You're on your own.
You what? You just, so how do you do it? You just stop taking on so many trans cases, or you set up a trans unit within the charity, within the nonprofit that can be spun off at a later date that handles trans things.
Something like that. I mean,
separate it somehow.
But also because if the trans movement wants to keep asking for things like self-ID and an approach to youth gender medicine that is kind of would concern a good number of gay people, they can't really do that in the context of an LGBTQ movement, because it doesn't represent, it undercuts the interest of some of that coalition. So I think they probably have to ease up on the gender medicine points that they're making. Probably just stop intervening in things like sports where the numbers are gone against them. Probably, and then I'd say, yeah, establish separate trans bodies within those organizations, and then just slowly wind down the association. You can do it through not taking on certain kinds of work, refocusing initially on issues like employment, housing, discrimination, that where there's probably higher support and less chance of clash with the interests of gay people. So it should be done sensitively. And because, you know, I think like most gay people, I really sincerely wish trans people well and want them to live happy lives. And it's, you know, for many people who've had gender dysphoria, it's a tough old road, and society is still, whatever the laws have been, is still not a great place. So I wish them well. But that's, yeah, again, separate from saying our cause is your cause. It's a package deal. Take it or leave it. Accommodating us means changing everything. It's not working for anybody. And it's not, no campaign has the duty to do that. I mean, no, I'm not sure if any other groups are told that. You must team with this other group because of some overlap. And it's a disgrace if you don't. I mean, women, I guess, to some degree, have been told that, but I struggle.
How did it happen? How did it happen, Ronan? Why are we here? I mean, you say that it's easier to not get together than to get a divorce. Why did we get together?
So I think a couple of things happened. First, there's always been some overlap. Second, mid-2010s, gay rights organizations thought they couldn't lose. And in the book, which I go to the end of the gay rights revolution, I set out the history of how, until that period, the gay rights organizations were saying, look, we wish you well, we can't touch this. It's too risky. But then when they had a run of success, they lost their fear. And they thought, oh, we can't lose. History's on our side. I mean, you always hear the campaigners say you're on the wrong side of history. So they thought they couldn't lose. And they thought, well, we don't worry about the consequences of taking it on. And then I don't think it was conscious, but it was also true that with the enactment of gay marriage across the West, at the very time the gay rights organizations had got a lot more corporate money, had a lot of funding, a lot of employees. Well, the guys Upton Sinclair said, it's hard to get, as this is a quote, it's hard to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on him not understanding.
And one of my favorite quotes, I cite it all the time.
And it's not like, I don't think anyone was cynically thinking, how do I keep my money coming in? But I imagine subconsciously, Pete, you know, you're sitting in a big gay rights organization, big budget, loads of corporate money coming in. You've got gay marriage and you look around and think, do we all go home? Do we cut our staff by 90% and just do stuff on budding in schools or helping gays in countries where there's been no gay rights advances as yet. That's a tough ask for anybody. I mean, I don't know what I would do in that situation. If my salary was on the line, maybe I would have, may also would have thought, well, let's get into these new issues. But it is, the timing is remarkable in that regard. And I said, I don't think it was cynical. I just think people lost their fear and allowed themselves to believe things that kept them.
Yeah. And there was a sense of, as you say, we're on the right side of history. The wind is at our back. We're winning. Let's keep doing good. And here's this other community that has always been by our side. You know, trans people always used gay bars as refuges, as places of solidarity and safety. Let's do them a solid, bring them into the tent. And that's
and there's no downside.
There's no downside because, and there's lots of upside because now we have something to send out to our corporate donors about why they should continue, yeah, funding us because we have more, there are more battles to be won.
Yes. And then it's just, to me, it's what it really, it didn't take account of actually the tensions between the gay rights and trans rights in some instances, but also it didn't, I don't think they realized how quickly things would turn. Because in 2015, nobody saw Donald Trump, no one saw the Ukraine war. People didn't realize that liberal democracy was not that stable as we thought it was. And also that a lot of the demographic changes in many countries in the West really hadn't made themselves felt yet. And that's all that is changing.
What do you mean by the demographic changes in the West?
Well, I mean, the reality is that, particularly in Europe, but most of the migration to Europe comes from, or a very large proportion of the migration to Europe comes from societies that are very, very hostile to homosexuality. And if you have an end of history view, you think, oh, well, anybody who comes, you know, liberal modernity is so seductive that anyone exposed to it will immediately adopt it. But that hasn't happened. And, you know, as I say in the book, if a lot of people from Alabama move to Luxembourg, attitudes towards gun ownership in Luxembourg would change. And if a lot of people from sub-Saharan Africa, Pakistan, Middle East, come to European countries, given that those places have very hostile attitudes to homosexuality, it's going to have an impact. There's also now, we now have the data which shows that the second and third generations, the children are of the immigrants, are not actually becoming more liberal. Actually, the opposite. IFOP, a French polling organization, a couple of weeks ago, showed that amongst the French Muslim population, the youngest generation is the most conservative generation. The generation born in France is more conservative than the generations born in places like Algeria and Morocco. And look, I'm not saying immigration policy is not going to be decided for gay rights. What I am saying is the gay rights movement needs to prepare for the societies they're in, and those societies are getting more conservative. In France, for the first time since polling began on the issue, the number of people who say homosexuality should be accepted is declining. Same in the US. In Britain, there was a very good book by a guy called Sartre Mansour, and he's a British guy of Pakistani origin, and he's very pro-gay rights, and he's a gay brother-in-law who he loves. But he said, look, I'm too honest a writer to say anything, but the gap between mainstream British attitudes and British Muslim attitudes to on homosexuality is what he called dispiritingly wide, and there are no reasons to think it's going to change. And Islam, even places like Ukraine, where a lot of Ukrainians go to Western Europe, they're quite anti-gay. Sub-Saharan African Christians tend not to be quite conservative. I mean, with religious difference, intermarriage is less, so it's probably slightly more of a long-term issue. But you know, it's just that Europe is undergoing demographic change that is unprecedented in peacetime. And, you know, big changes bring big changes. Mm. And there's a lot of good changes that come, but also some of those changes are going to be bad. And because socially conservative areas are sending a lot of people to Europe, that's going to change things. How could it not?
Yes, and it would not be crazy to assume that the things that are most difficult to change in Western countries will be the things that have the deepest roots and the longest traditions. And the things that are probably the easiest to see backtracking on are the most recent and novel wins. And since gay rights is the most recent civil rights success, it's quite vulnerable in a way that perhaps traditions of free speech or, freedom of religion or other liberal precepts would not be.
And it is more of an ask, which is really interesting because the World Values Survey shows that in terms of liberal democratic support for liberal for democracy, there isn't that much of a difference actually between the most Western countries and Muslim majority countries. Even on gender equality, the gap is not that big. It's on homosexuality that the biggest gap is. The stat in the book, actually, I think that stops most people in their tracks more than any other is that the most anti-gay region in the UK is London, by a long way. And, London has a huge gay population. It's generally been the liberal capital, but it also has a very high migrant population. So, migration is complex. There's lots of reasons for it and against it. But it just does mean that particularly for gay rights, societies are becoming less accommodating and less favourable.
So if the wins, if gay rights are not a done deal that we can just sort of put on the shelf and park, but something that needs to be re-articulated and re-defended with every generation or every decade, the other people who need winning over, if not new migrant communities, are conservatives, cultural conservatives. You talk about what we should learn from Putin and Orban, who you mentioned earlier, and the trajectory of especially American Christian nationalism and conservatism and the transition from the secular conservatism of a Mitt Romney or, that era or even a George H.W. Bush into this new ascendancy of a more Charlie Kirk end of liberalism, getting back to family values, vision of conservatism. Can you give us the lay of that land?
Sure, yeah. So,
g'day, humans. Well, if you've listened to this much of the episode, then you must enjoy it, presumably, unless you're just listening for masochistic reasons. So you should listen to the rest of it. And the way you do that is by subscribing to the premium feed, where you not only get to hear the rest of this delightful conversation, and trust me, oh, it gets better than what you just heard, but you also get to hear no ads, zero ads. And previously, up until now, you had to go to the old Substack to do that and follow me on Substack and add one more platform to your life if you're not already on Substack. But here's the thing. We are now on Apple Premium Podcast as well. So with one click, Apple will just subscribe you up to the premium feed. You'll be able to listen to the rest of this conversation right now, right now, right now. So open up your Apple Podcasts, click the old Pay Old Zepsy button. That's probably what it's called, Pay Old Zepsy. And you click the button and then you no longer have to be a free rider. You can feel like you're contributing to the mission of this show, which is really what we're all here for. Better conversations, a freer, more freewheeling attitude towards the things that we can talk about, a way to steel man our opponents and to take the most gracious approach towards disagreement. That is what you're voting for when you vote for Uncomfortable Conversations by going into your Apple Podcasts and clicking subscribe. I love you. If you don't do that, that's fine. I'll see you the next free episode, I guess. Take care.